Good evening. This is Carol Murphy, and you're listening to Heartstock Radio once again. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. We have a very well-anticipated program this evening, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. Linda Welsh is in the studio, and she's going to be talking about Sage Mountain Center, which is actually in our neck of the woods here, very close to our lovely hometown of Butte. Just a moment, Linda will come back and tell us all about what she does at Sage Mountain Center, and stick with us. Thank you so much for being here. Be right back.
You and me. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Hi again. Carol Murphy, and you're listening to Heartstock Radio. Thank you so much. I'm really glad that you're all here. And once again, we have a fantastic guest this evening. Her name is Linda Welsh, and I've had the great privilege and honor of visiting Sage Mountain Center a couple times, and I can tell you it is absolutely stunningly gorgeous, among many other things. So, Linda's here in the studio. So, Linda, tell our guests who you are and what you do.
Hello, Carol. Thank you for having me. And hello to everyone out there in Radio Land. I am a hospice nurse administrator. That's what I do for work. And I also work at the Montana Chemical Dependency Center. And that's been a very rich learning experience for me. I have a LLC called Nectar Enterprises, and my mission with Nectar Enterprises is to create beautiful, affordable, efficient housing in Butte. But my deepest love has been the co-founding of Sage Mountain Center, which is located in between Butte and Whitehall, up on the Continental Divide, about 6,300 feet. And my partner, Christopher, and I have been working to build that place for about 26 years.
Holy moly. I didn't realize it was 26 years. So
we started when we were five.
Evidently. Yes, you were ambitious at that age. So let's begin at the beginning. What was the inspiration, and can you give us kind of a summary of your path?
Yes. Let's see if I can give that.
Synopsis.
Let's see if I could give that a try.
26 years.
Yeah. So Christopher and I grew up in Northern California, and when I think about trying to distill what it was that inspired us to embark on this adventure, I really came to the conclusion that it was love, that it was love of the wild and curiosity about wild places. Christopher used to spend all of his time running up to Annadale State Park. He lived in a pretty suburban area, and that was something that he exposed me to, backpacking. And I really felt that when I was backpacking, that I had this sense of homecoming, but also a sense of estrangement a little bit. Like I was there, but I didn't really understand the language of the place. And so our curiosity and our wish to explore what we would create if presented with kind of a clean canvas, how would we choose to live? What could we create in the absence of precedent? And so we found this property pretty high up in the Rocky Mountains, and we started to experiment and innovate and try and imagine a life that was based on principles of sustainable living and notice what the place itself would give rise to. Like, we wanted to be informed by and mentored by the place itself. So those were some of the underpinnings of starting Sage Mountain Center, and it's been quite a ride.
I love those origins. It's absolutely innovative and fresh that you were able to have that kind of blank slate that you started from.
Yes, it was really a beautiful process to kind of get quiet in that place and imagine and look at the animals, what animals migrate through there, who lives here year-round, the species that live here year-round, what kind of shelter do they construct? And we noticed that the animals that were around, aside from deer and elk and moose, lived underground and or hibernated. And so we embarked on creating earthen-like structures. We didn't have the engineering background to build underground, but using cordwood masonry and straw bale construction that are both using earth plasters that are create walls that are very dense, that have a lot of thermal mass, that provide a lot of insulation, we were able to mimic that underground feature so that we have super efficient buildings that are really comfortable in any weather.
Yes, and before we get into the actual materials and the construction of the many buildings that are on the property, I would like to talk just a little bit more about this path that led you there. How did you find the property, and what made you know inside of yourself, this is it, this is the right place for us?
We were pretty strategic for being 5 years old. and we had a list of things that we were looking for. We knew we needed a place that would have good soil because we wanted to participate in growing our own food. We wanted to live off the grid. We wanted to generate our power with sun and with wind. So we needed a property that had good sun exposure. We also were interested in having the buildings kind of arise from the materials existing on the land itself. So we were interested in wooded property. And of course, everyone wants a river running through it, right? Which our property does not have. But it was kind of a logical decision when we came to the property, and we didn't really fall in love with it until we discovered an aspen grove on the west side of the property, and then it really captured our imagination. And over time, it's interesting when you have a piece of property, it kind of has you. And people talk about owning a place, but I have always felt like the greatest gift for me is belonging to a place. And then, of course, you have to pay for it. So there's a relationship there as well. So, yeah, that's our focus really over the years has been food and water, shelter and power. And so we've been trying to innovate in those domains and see what we could do to transition away from an oil-based lifestyle to one that's more sustainable.
Okay, so next I would really like you to talk more, and I definitely want, it's, you're doing some great intros here, because the next thing I want to talk about is the energy and the food that you've been able to basically create sustainably. First, though, let's talk about the structures themselves, because first of all, the thing that really impressed me the most when I've gone and gotten to the privilege of visiting is, number one, how beautiful the structures are, and number two, how they feel when you are in the presence of them. And you kind of touched on that a little bit ago, I think, when you were talking about when Christopher first took you to open land and backpacking. There is a definite, for me, it's a very palpable feeling of warmth and nurturing and peace. And I felt that same connectedness to nature when I was in the structures or standing next to them on the ground. So that feeling was at times almost overwhelming. Just really, it was like, wow, so this is what it's supposed to feel like, kind of thing. Can you talk about the buildings and how they came about, the design and the actual construction and all that fun stuff?
Sure, sure. Thank you. Those are very kind perceptions. Thank you. So, as I said, we knew we wanted to use materials on the land, and we knew, given the extreme climate, that we needed structures that were going to perform very well in an extreme environment. We had a lot of deadwood everywhere on the property. The property had been logged, and there was just a lot of slash piles everywhere. So we did some research, and this is before the internet, which I know is hard to imagine, but we did some research and came upon a technique called stack wall construction or cordwood construction. We got this little hand-typed document from the Bozeman Library that was some guy in Canada did. And the idea was to use wood kind of as a filler and to put it width-wise in the wall. So unlike a log structure that has the logs vertical and doesn't necessarily create a very well insulated place, the cordwood construction technique, you put the logs widthwise in the wall, so the wall's 16 inches, in our case, could be 24 inches wide. And then those logs are laid up in a mortar matrix. And so the walls look a little bit like stone, but the R value, R being resistance to cold and heat, for a cordwood wall is about R25. And for straw bale, depending on what kind of bales you use, it's about R40. So what you have is you're using a waste material in both cases, and you are using earth. Our mortar mix is masonry sand and Portland cement because we don't have much clay, and then sifted topsoil. So the earth that you're removing, you're plastering back on the wall. And you're that very dense, thick wall acts like a battery. It's one of the things that we don't do very well in our modern construction. We don't think of our walls as functioning like a battery. So if you orient your home well, at this latitude, you want to orient your home to the south, and you want to have about 40 to 70% glass on the south. You're inviting the light and the heat of the sun into your space. And when that sun hits those massive walls, heat is absorbed. And then in the evening, when the room temperature goes down, that heat flows out of the walls. So when you have this informed design, you don't have to put a lot of human energy into the space to heat it or to light it. So at Sage Mountain Center, even though the space is big, because we do workshops and have events there, we only use about a fifth of the power that, you know, a little apartment in Butte would use. So you can create very efficient homes. And one of the things we love to demonstrate is that you can have all of the comforts that we have grown to expect in our North American society for just a fraction of the energy.
Talk a little bit about the buildings and other accoutrements that you have on the property, because you have this grand, what I would like to call, you know, kind of main center, master home, master whatever, and master center, and then you have several outbuildings. Talk a little bit about
that. Yeah, so since we had never constructed with these techniques, we created a 10-year plan, and we started with a small cottage, which we kind of buried in the woods because we didn't know if those walls were going to come crumbling down at any point. So Tilting Tree Cottage, which we did actually burn down by accident at one point. So Tilting Tree Cottage number 2 is a combination of straw bale construction and cordwood masonry, and it's occupied by our roommate, Carol. She's an engineer, and she's joined our little four musketeers now we have living there. And then we took a lot of notes from that effort, and we built the second phase, which is the guest house, and you can see these buildings on Airbnb.com. The guest house is Sage Mountain Center Guest House. And that is a 6-bedroom, 2-bath. It's just like a bunkhouse, bedrooms and bathrooms. And we lived there 10 or 11 years. But it's a load-bearing cordwood structure, meaning that the cordwood walls are bearing the load of the roof. And it's a fossil fuel-free home. So we're heating water with taps or thermal air panels, and we're heating water whenever we have a wood stove fire. We're taking advantage of the tendency of hot air to rise, and cold water is heavier. And so there's a loop there in the firebox that's connected to a recycled cast iron tank in the gable end of the roof, which preheats water. And so you just look at the little digital thermometer, and if it's warm enough, then you have a shower. And if you don't want to wait, you know, you can turn on the propane water heater. But for the most part, it's a fossil fuel-free home. So we love taking advantage of the tendency of hot air to rise or hot water to rise, and really using the natural thermodynamics that we're surrounded by to our advantage.
As I like to say, someone's using their noggin here.
All right. It's Chris.
We're going to take a brief break, a little music break. We'll be right back.
And I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of a diamond dance. And all around me, a voice was sound. This land was made for you and me. Oh, when the sun came shining and I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling, as the fog was lifting, a voice was chanting, this land was made for you and me. And as I went walking, I saw it sign there.
Thanks everybody for listening. This is Carol Murphy, and you're listening to Heartstock Radio. In the studio today, we have Linda Welsh. She's from Sage Mountain Center. So, our segue into energy, which I think is just so inspirational. The fact that you guys can live off the grid. And I've heard so many people, naysayers, saying, oh, you can't do that. You know, it's Montana and the sun doesn't shine enough. And, you know, I've even heard people say things like, well, you have to have all specialized appliances for your home. You can't run normal appliances off of a solar house. And okay, let's hear the truth.
Well, living off the grid has never been more doable than it is now. The price of solar panels is the cheapest it's ever been worldwide. And the whole solar and wind industry have outpaced every other technology in the last year or two: oil, natural gas, nuclear, coal. So renewable energy as an industry is really booming worldwide. And you mentioned people saying we don't have enough sun in Montana. We have an average of 4.5 sun hours a day, and that is the same as Florida. So we have a lot of sun here. And since it's cooler, a lot of people imagine places like Arizona and desert areas as being ideal for solar, but heat can interfere with efficiency of the panels. So we have beautiful sun hours here, and we have cool temperatures. We also get a nice reflection from the snow. And so Montana could not be more ideal for capturing the power of wind and of photovoltaic panels. So there's four components to an off-grid system. There's your solar generators, which is your solar array. Those are the polycrystalline looking panels that you'll see on people's roofs. Not the big fat ones. Those are the ones that are heating water. These are the ones that are shiny. And what happens is the light, the photons hit these panels and they excite the electrons. And that's what electricity is, the flow of electrons. So you have a controller that controls this flow that's coming from your solar generators. And then you have a battery bank. And we have just delved into the new technology of battery banks, which are lithium ion batteries. And I don't know too much about them yet. We just got them in the last month, except that they charge very quickly and they're very light. The lead acid batteries are super heavy. They weigh like 175 pounds for a 2-volt battery cell. So the battery bank holds the energy that you've created during daylight hours so that you can draw off that energy when the sun goes down and if it's not windy. And the fourth component is an inverter or a converter that changes the current that's stored in your battery bank to alternating current. So your whole house can be wired conventionally and all of your appliances can be conventional appliances. Our refrigerator comes from Sears there on Harrison Avenue. So you really do not need specialized appliances, and you just buy the most efficient ones that you can afford. And it's very doable. And one of the beautiful things that I appreciate about living off the grid is it kind of ties you into what's happening outside. You know, if it's windy, I'm like, oh, I have an abundance of power. I think I'll vacuum today or do laundry or whatever. Maybe do all of those things, turn on all of my electric loads. And it ties you into the movement of the sun and the trajectory of the sun, which is different in winter than it is in summer. And these are all awarenesses that I didn't have before. So I appreciate also how clean it is. And a lot of people argue that the amount of energy that goes into creating a solar panel kind of eliminates the benefit. But these panels, I think Christopher taught me that it takes a couple of years for a panel to generate the amount of power that it took to create it, which, you know, I realize it depends on the panel, it depends on the manufacturer, et cetera, et cetera. But that's a pretty quick payback time. And certainly trying to work towards getting away from oil is definitely what we know we have to do as a society. And I really understand the power of oil, you know, when you look at the amount of embodied energy in a 40 or 42 gallon barrel of oil, it's like 10 years of work, of human labor. So how much does a barrel of oil cost these days? $100, $130? I don't know the exact amount, but 10 years of work for a human being, that's a lot of embodied energy. So I understand why our modern communities are addicted to oil. It's very powerful. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the next adventure, it's like not a trip to the moon, it's not climbing Mount Everest, it's transitioning our communities to clean sources of power.
Yeah, and you know, there's a date in the future that is invisible in most of our minds, and that date mm-hmm. is when the last drop of oil is sucked out of the ground mm-hmm. that we don't often think about, that at some point we've got this huge machine that is running the oil industry, and that whole machine known as civilization is going to come to a screeching halt if we have not intelligently transitioned. So that's the thing that is in the back of my mind. It's much healthier for the environment, but it's also going to run out at some point.
And we know that the powers that be are not going to stop that trajectory of using these fossil fuels until they do run out. But that doesn't mean that the rest of us can't behave in a more sane fashion. And I love the idea that it doesn't matter your political affiliation, it does not matter your ethnicity, your country of origin, it does not matter your faith community. We can all agree that our species needs quantities of clean water and quantities of clean air and quantities of clean food. And to me, that represents a baseline moral ideal that every single person on the planet can agree upon. So especially since starting to work at the Montana Chemical Dependency Center, I noticed that many of our leaders are behaving in an addicted fashion, in that they are behaving in a compulsive way that persists despite harmful effects. And so I think we as a people, as a democratic nation, have to say, okay, everybody, we say no to anything, to any industry that is going to foul our air, foul our water, or foul our soil. It's very simple. So any company or economic project that wants to take place cannot cross that basic precautionary value. The technology is certainly there.
Yeah, and you know, what we see here in our hometown is the cost of cleaning it up when we do.
Indeed.
Who is that dumped on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
The little ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not fair.
No, no. And, you know, with regard to food, for example, there's a lot of arsenic and lead in our soils here, but there's also Chad Anderson, one of my heroes. Give him a call from the health department. He'll come and evaluate your soil and help replace it if it's contaminated. So I think we can begin to participate a little bit more in those domains of food, power, water, and shelter. Yeah. Work to transition.
Okay, we've got about 2 minutes left. Tell me about some of the events that you've had in the past and some of the events that are coming up at Sage Mountain that people can participate in.
Sure. Well, one of the things we have ongoing at all times is Airbnb, which I feel is a beautiful cultural exchange. You can come and stay at Sage Mountain Center. We keep our prices at very affordable levels. Our road is a bit of a mess at the moment, so I did put our listings on I guess it's called put them to sleep until the spring. But Airbnb is a wonderful way to come and spend some time up on the mountain. We also participate in the Woofing program. Woofing is worldwide workers on organic farms. And so we love to welcome young folks, old folks, whoever, from around the world who are interested in working in our permaculture gardens and innovating with us around permaculture principles. We are going to be hosting a yoga teacher's training this spring, and that'll be a beautiful, holistic way to use our space. And Christopher Borton, his focus is consulting and helping people build in an intelligent and informed way and also modify existing homes towards efficiency.
And Christopher is your partner?
Yeah.
Excellent. And how might folks reach out to you?
Christopher Borton can be reached at www.sagemountain.org. And our website is sagemountaincenter.org. And so that's the best way you can reach him for any kind of consulting or any kind of renewable energy or construction questions through our website.
And that's a big part of what you do.
Yes.
Yes, is to
education.
Help. Yes, education and help others, because you were kind of plowing new ground, so to speak, and had to do it on your own. So you've shown the light for those who will follow, and that's exponential.
Right? Well, we love to try and save other people time. So I can say, you know, it's 6,300 feet with very low humidity and snow that can happen at any time. You know, the 45-day growing season or whatever it is now. These are the 30 cultivars. These are the 30 annuals that you can grow that will thrive in those kinds of dynamics.
Because we all know we hate it when we go outside and see our garden dead because it froze.
Yeah.
This is Heartstock, and today we've had the honor and privilege of speaking with Linda Welsh from Sage Mountain Center. Thanks so much. And, you know,
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. And I hope that at some point we might be able to repeat this, because I feel like there's so much that we could talk about, and it's an awesome subject. Peace, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5, Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at buteamericaradio.org. This land was made.